Candygram for Whitney.
Wait a minute. Are you really a Candygram?
No, I'm a person.
I think you're that clever shark.
What? What?
Are you really that clever shark, or are you really a Candygram?
What?
Well, okay, I guess I'll open the door.
I don't get you sometimes.
Oh, fine. Greetings, friends. Welcome to a very special, critically acclaimed, the Letters episode, where highbrow and lowbrow collide.
Wait for it. Wait for it. Oh. Wait for it. It's a little late.
Oh, it's on the bus. There it is. It's running a little behind today. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed. This is going to be a very special letters episode. We get so many letters from you, our dear listeners, and we record at such strange times that we typically don't have time to read all of your letters in our typical episodes, so we decided just to pack them all in one.
Yeah, we're going to start doing, every month, we're going to do a letters episode. We'll still try to do a couple letters a week if we can, but you guys write us so much, and we love what you write. You write such interesting, intelligent things, and you ask such great questions that you really deserve your time, so I want to give you an episode every month.
Now, some of you answers ask some very hard questions, and we're grateful for the challenge. To introduce ourselves, though, just in case this might be your first episode, my name is Whitney Seibold. I'm a film critic for the whole of the internet. I write for IGN. I'm still on the payroll at Nerdist. They haven't published one of my pieces in about a year, but whatever. I also have a co-host. Who are you?
My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a film critic for The Wrap and IGN and criticallyacclaimed.net. And everybody calls me Bibbs. And yeah, letters.
We get letters. We get letters.
Yeah, and we
get sacks and sacks of letters.
And we do weird bits about a shark that you don't tell me about before.
You know what? I thought you were well-versed in your Saturday Night Live lore, but I guess you're not.
I missed that one.
You don't know that one.
You know, it's been on for a bit.
That's true, but I thought that one was a classic, like the Coneheads or the Wild and Crazy Guys. Like people, it's just sort of leaked into consciousness.
Yeah, that one I forgot.
All right.
So anyway, if you want to email us, Whitney, what's the email address?
It is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net.
And
we'll get them.
And we'll read as many as we can. We get so many letters that we're not going to be able to get to them all in this episode. So if we miss yours, we apologize. We're going to do the best we can and cover as many topics as we can. So if we get a bunch of letters about the same topic, we might have to whittle that down a bit. But yeah, let's just get started. All Whitney, right. Where do you want to go?
I'm going to start back with one of our oldest unanswered letters.
Oh, dear.
Which
back from 2012.
No. Mid-August, but here's a letter from Ben Rudin. Hi, Ben. Oh, by the way, if you write in, put the name you'd like to be addressed as at the bottom. If you don't put a name down there, we'll just assume you don't want us to read your name.
That is
on the
true.
Show.
Yeah, we will do that.
But Ben has put his name. So hello, Ben. Hey, Bibbs and Whitney. I've been a listener all summer and love the content you've been providing. As I am a college student, I'm home for the summer semester, and having only truly gotten into watching movies quite recently, I feel as though this is a great time to catch up. That's included taking some recommendations from my parents as to films they've particularly liked in the past and I might not have thought of. That led to my watching of Clint Eastwood's 2008 film, Gran Torino. And, well, I found myself more than a little conflicted. And that's beyond just the surprising weakness, either in the actor's delivery or the dialogue itself. Two questions have stemmed from this. Firstly, how do you yourselves negotiate with films that might feel sort of good but are so obviously white savior films? On the one hand, this movie has some real beauty to it and seems to be as much about the terrible things done by Eastwood's character in the past as his necessary redemption, but it's also plainly about how a white man single-handedly saved the Hmong neighborhood, and he literally collapses into a cruciform in the film.
I actually haven't seen Gran Torino, but I know all about it, and you just knocked a bunch of things off my table, and we're not going to cut that out. We're just going to leave your shame
in
the podcast.
I'm just gesticulating so wildly.
Yeah.
Secondly, and less broadly, what do you think about these recurring problems of double-edged films in the Eastwood directorial filmography, thinking particularly of 2010's Invictus? Thanks a bunch, Ben. P.S. I recognize my question rambled on enough as it is, but if y'all have the time, I don't believe I ever caught you guys reviewing Paul Schrader's First Reformed. I was wondering what you think of it.
I missed First Reformed in theaters. It's on home video now. I've been meaning to catch up to it. I have a lot of things I need to catch up on before we do our best of the year list.
Yeah, it's on my to-get-to list, as well as some film, like popular films that are still in theaters.
So we'll get to that eventually. Sorry.
Clint Eastwood's White Savior Complex. Unfortunately, it's there. A lot of his earlier films were less forthrightly political. He's always been a political guy. I mean, he was a mayor, for goodness sake. He was mayor of Carmel, California.
Yeah.
I remember a joke from the show The Critic. They said, here's another show with Clint Eastwood and a talking orangutan. And incidentally, both of them served as mayor of Carmel, California.
I don't remember that at all.
But Gran Torino is very much a story of a marginalized community seen through the eyes of the white guy.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of the film, he's, you know, just sort of this grouchy old man. And by the time he picks up the gun and says, get off my lawn, he's telling it to, like, other bad guys who would hurt the people that he's grown close to.
Yeah.
As Clint Eastwood has gotten older, it's been harder and harder to ignore.
Well, here's the deal. He's a product of his time. He's like in his 80s right now,
yeah,
right? He's
still making movies. So
yeah, and some of
it's
his
like
movies
89,
are...
He's almost 90.
Some of his movies are really, really good. And I think particularly like through the early to mid-90s, he was really on fire. He made some good films in the 2000s, but... Yeah, he's a Republican. He is very conservative in his values, and those will turn off a lot of his audiences, myself included. Mm. But yeah, when it comes to negotiating this whole white savior complex that a lot of movies have, and this is not limited to Clint Eastwood. Look at the films of Ed Zwick sometimes. everything from The Last Samurai, who was a white dude.
Courage Under Fire.
Courage Under Fire.
Because like Meg Ryan was like the sacrificial character in that one.
Yeah, I'm thinking more like Glory, in which you're telling a story of like this monumentally important black battalion in the Civil War, but the protagonist is their white commanding officer played by Matthew Broderick. Like, Denzel Washington should not have been the supporting actor in that movie. It's a weird, weird focus.
The one that really, really rubbed me the wrong way was Wind Talkers.
Yeah.
About, like, the real Navajo speakers who had to invent a code based on Navajo to hide military maneuvers from the Japanese, and the Japanese could not figure out the Navajo language at all.
Yeah, which is an interesting real-life story.
And it was about the Navajo wind, they called them wind talkers, had to go out into the battlefield and scream codes and, you know, while bombs were going off all around them. And it was all about how Nicolas Cage had to protect his wind talker.
Well, the plot was how Nicolas Cage was responsible for protecting this guy because he's the only person in the battalion who knew the code. Mm. But also, if it looked like the wind talker in their troop was about to be captured, he had to kill him. Which is admittedly interesting, but the protagonist should not be Nicolas Cage in that instance. It's so weird.
It should be the Navajo speaker, and he should like have a conversation with his protector, who's a supporting character, saying, you know, if things get down, like he'll actually admit that when things get really bad, I'm gonna have to kill you. It's like, well, you know what? I hope things don't go that way.
Look, Hollywood history, much like actual history, is rife with problems. And as we get older, as generation after generation, you know, succeeds each other on this planet, we're going to realize that every generation was wrong about stuff. And as much as we think we're right about stuff now and we're trying to fix a lot of problems, 20 years from now, another generation is going to look back on what we're doing right now and say they still didn't have it right.
Whatever we're saying right now, we're saying things right now we think are terribly progressive, and it's going to seem really regressive in a generation.
It's practically a guarantee.
It's just a matter of trying to continually updating ourselves. Now,
and sometimes that means reevaluating what we've done in the past.
A lot of this whole sort of white savior complex, though, especially when with older filmmakers like Clint Eastwood, is they're not teaching themselves how to shut up and cede the floor to the voices that need to be heard right now.
They think the important story is that they learned a lesson and now they can teach everyone else. Yeah. And no, the power of cinema is to put you in the position of other people, not to put you in there by proxy.
Right.
And just say like, and so see, you're in there. Good for you. Like, no, I don't care anymore. I'm over it.
One of the more progressive films to come out in the last couple of years might be Cars 3.
Yeah.
Because Cars 3 is a story about an older male character who is past his prime.
White male. Well, as much as a car can be. He's Owen Wilson. He doesn't get a lot whiter.
He's played by a white actor. He's red. Okay, he's got a red paint job.
All right.
Except that one scene where he has primer. I don't want to put race on the cars, for goodness sake.
Okay.
You can say that the Italian race car is Italian. That's fine, because it was built in Italy. But it's about an older guy who has to learn to step aside and let somebody who is much more intelligent, a Latina woman.
That's my my point.
Yeah,
it's race does enter into it. It's Cruz Ramirez.
Her name is Cruz Ramirez, yeah. And she's taking over for him. And it's about his lesson about how he gets to step aside now and let the new generation of more talented women of color take his place.
Yeah.
Clint Eastwood should watch Cars 3.
I mean, still, you could still make an argument that there's a white savior element to that because we had to put Owen Wilson's character in the lead.
He had to sort of give that to her, but, you know, that they both acknowledge by the end that she has more talent and she gets to do it now. So, yeah.
It's something we're going to deal with and wrestle with, and we're going to reevaluate older films. This is normal. We don't have to protect older films. Mm. Like, oh, well, it's so rude to look back on it now. Like, no, if it doesn't play now, that's okay. So, it might be lame if you liked it once, but like if you can't watch it anymore because it's aged poorly, that's part of life. You don't have to protect the things you liked when you were young. You don't. Yeah. It's okay to put them aside.
Yeah. Gran Torino is only a decade old, however.
Yeah.
And it's not a matter of sort of dismissing the previous generation. This was just an older guy trying to continue with the same kind of narrative that he was used to telling.
But Eastwood is of like four generations hence. He just happens to still be making movies.
He has acquired such filmmaking skill that you can watch something like Gran Torino and really appreciate the emotional beats, the filmmaking, the pacing, the photography, all of the professional technical elements that go into it. But it's okay to kind of feel like you're being tricked by slick filmmaking into thinking that this might be a healthier story than perhaps it is.
Yeah.
And that's your job as a critical viewer.
Yeah.
Anyway. Why don't you read a letter?
Anyway, we're all trying our best here and, you know, Whitney and I are white dudes.
Yeah. Don't listen to us. We're white.
Yeah. Like seriously, there are other more important critics to listen to. You ask us for our opinion. We gave it to you. We're trying our best. We're probably screwing something up. We want to do the right thing. We want to do good. And we're going to keep trying and we're going to keep trying to fix ourselves as best we can, which is what I think everyone should be trying to do. Mm. Okay. Let's see what we got here. I didn't have, I didn't have one here. Okay, here's one from Paul Kanosian and the Backward Running Vomit.
Oh, Paul Kanosian is a listener of ours.
Yeah.
He is just a listener of ours. And
that's an in-joke.
It was an in-joke that really, to explain to the listeners of Critically Acclaimed, we did an episode of Cancel Too Soon devoted to the Fox show Freaky Links. And at the end of every episode of Freaky Links, as we watched it, they announced which bands had performed in it. And they were all forgotten bands from the early 2000s.
If you watch any, like, if you had any, like, recordings of TV shows from, like, the late 90s, early 2000s, every episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Veronica Mars would be like, tonight's episode of Veronica Mars featured music by blank.
Yeah, and prompting you to run out and buy the record because there were still record stores then.
So at the end of our Freaky Links episode, we ended it with tonight's episode of Cancel Too Soon featured music by, and we listed, what was it, like 120 bands?
It was like 150 around that. We just made up 150 bands, and one of them in tribute to our listener Paul Kanosian was Paul Kanosian and the Backward Running Vomit.
So thank you.
So he has now adopted our made up band.
That's great. All right. Dear Milieu, and suffice it to say. Fair enough.
All right, fair.
Take a drink when I say suffice it to say as well.
And when I try to say milieu. And
I've noticed I do that.
Yeah.
Okay. You guys are great, and you have brilliant insights. And yes, y'all are smarter than I when it comes to film.
Oh, pshaw.
So you got me to watch Streets of Fire.
Yay!
It was okay.
No!
But so fake, and just about everything about it rang hollow. Mm. I was casting around for the perfect second feature and came up with Kathryn Bigelow's Loveless. I would have put up Streets of Fire as the bad movie and Loveless as the good movie. Think about it. They both have Willem Dafoe as the criminal motorbike riding greaser, and they came out the same year. Everything Streets of Fire gets wrong, Loveless gets right. It's like comparing Sha-na-na, singing about hubcaps and soda shops, with the Cramps. We did a song called Can Your Pussy Do the Dog.
Wait, which movie is the Cramps and which movie is Sha-na-na in this
I'm pretty sure Loveless is the Cramps.
Okay.
Loveless really captures the gritty existential scuzziness and subtly the racism of the time. But at the end of the day, it all comes down to what you like. I'm from the East Coast and I grew up in a crappy little hick town where you had to learn to fight, so I think I related more to Loveless. I have absolutely no doubt, however, that Streets of Fire is better than the Flintstones. There aren't too many things in life that I can be 100% certain of, but I'm certain of that. It's a great letter, Paul. Thank you. So I can appreciate that Streets of Fire might have been one of our
more controversial selections.
Maybe not controversial, but maybe, you know, not everyone's going to be on board with us saying that one is truly great. I maintain it was a great pick for a double feature with the Flintstones.
Yeah.
And I think we were both appreciating it as a cult film. And a cult film doesn't have to be perfection, because if it achieved perfection, it probably wouldn't be a cult film.
No.
A cult film is usually something that is hard for some people to get on board with, but the people who really dig it love the hell out of it. And so Streets of Fire, I think you're right, it is kind of shallow. That's kind of the point. It is an empty style exercise, but I think it's a very good one.
What was it Bruce Campbell said? A hit film is when, like, 100,000 people see a movie 10 times. A cult film is when 10 people see a movie 100,000 times.
And he'd rather be part of that. Was his argument. I mean, think about how many hit movies. Like, go to any year, like, 10 years ago or more, and look at, like, the top 20 highest-grossing films of that year. Now, think about, there's some of those movies that are still hits. And there are some movies that were successful, people liked them okay, and now they're mostly forgotten. In fact, I'm going to do this as an exercise. Box Office Mojo. I'm going to pick a year at random, and we're just going to pick some films that were popular at the time, and now no one gives a shit. Give me a year in the 90s.
The 90s. 94.
1994.
I'd say 93, but I know Jurassic Park is up there, and that's kind of still rolling on.
Okay, so the top few are still very well liked for the most part. We got Forrest Gump. The tide has turned a bit on that, but there's still a lot of fans. The Lion King is considered an animated classic.
Still need to see that.
True Lies is troubling in some regards. It's not really available anymore. Like,
it's
weird.
It's not. I remember really enjoying it at the time for its humor, but it has some racial politics that aren't so healthy.
And sexual politics, which are really a problem. The Santa Claus is considered at least a minor Christmas classic, and a lot of people like that movie.
I know it had two sequels.
The first movie's cute. It holds up okay.
This is so embarrassing. That's the last movie I saw in the Cinerama Dome.
Wow.
I haven't seen a movie in the Cinerama Dome since The Santa Claus.
For me, it was Roland Emmerich's Godzilla.
Hey.
There you go.
So we're both embarrassed.
Okay, then we have The Flintstones.
There it is.
Huge hit. No one gives a shit now. Dumb and Dumber. Okay. Clear and Present Danger. Okay. Actually, the top 10's pretty good. We got Speed, Pulp Fiction. Then we hit, the top 20. Maverick.
I like Maverick.
But who talks about it anymore? No one really cares anymore. No one's saying, you know what movie you should see?
People were Maverick. 15 in 1994.
Disclosure. A film that has aged very poorly in a lot of ways.
Disclosure is... Yeah, nobody talks about Disclosure because we're just trying to ignore it.
Trying to pretend we didn't do that one. Let's see what we got here. Legends of the Fall was a big hit. No one cares.
Well, we don't care because we're men. That was a big slumber party hit for, like, my female peers.
But who talks about it? When was the last time someone said, hey, you know a movie I love to this day? Legends of the Fall.
It's true. I don't hear that a lot.
Like, I hear that more often about A River Runs Through It, and nobody talks about that one either. The Specialist?
Oh, gosh, I didn't think of for a
with
second.
Sharon which Stone and Sylvester Stallone.
I haven't seen it. But
gone. Yeah. It's gone. No one cares. So it's actually a better ratio in 1994 than many other years. But yeah, it's just, you know.
There are a few more, more adult-skewing films, too.
Well,
like
before the Marvelization of the box office, there were more adult-skewing films.
That were bigger hits, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking of Clear and Present Danger. Not that that's, a terribly adult film, but it's slightly more sophisticated than, Speed.
Well, like, look at the 1993. You got the number one film of the year was Jurassic Park. Okay. Yeah. Number two is Mrs. Doubtfire. Okay. Number three is The Fugitive, which is a very mature thriller. Mm-hmm. It's not like a fun, dopey thriller like Fast and the Furious. It's a serious movie that happens to be a thriller. The Firm, which you watch that again today, that's a very smart movie.
Yeah.
That's just a smart, well-acted movie. Sleepless in Seattle was the fifth highest grossing film that year.
That's amazing. Yeah.
See, Indecent Proposal was number six. In the Line of Fire was number seven. Pelican Brief was number eight. Schindler's List was number nine. And then Cliffhanger.
The big dumb action,
movie, which is a good fun action movie. I like that movie a lot. But like that's mostly older skewing movies for more mature audiences than what we have now, which are movies that maybe everyone loves them, but they're designed so that everyone can enjoy them from 5 to 85.
I'm trying to think, like, in the last decade or so, what was, like, the last gigantic romance? Like, the big romantic comedy?
Romantic comedy, just romance.
I guess The Fault in Our Stars was a big hit.
That was a huge hit.
It wasn't, like, number one, but it was a big hit.
Yeah, that one did good. Mm-hmm. Let's see what we got here. We're getting massively sidetracked.
Oh, it's fun.
Beauty and the Beast was a hit, obviously, but that's
a terrible movie. I don't want to talk about that one. It's still like number two. Like it's
It was right behind
Avengers.
It was Star Wars, then Beauty and the Beast. Let's see what we got here for other romances. No, nothing in 2016 to speak of.
Superheroes and Star Wars.
Cinderella was the ninth highest grossing film of 2015.
Okay,
that's actually a good Disney remake.
One of the few.
Let's try two more years.
That's not like an adult romance. Like a cartoon remake.
Like a hit adult romance. Yeah, there weren't a lot of those. And there haven't been a lot of really big hit ones in a really long time. Yeah, nothing's coming up for a bit.
Somebody asked me on Twitter recently, like, what can we do to stem this tide? Like, the big hit movies are all kind of the same. They're all part of the same franchises, really. It's like Star Wars and the Avengers. And my only answer was, don't go.
Yeah, just don't go.
It's up to you. You can change it. You just don't pay for these things.
We've created this culture in which people think that because it's part of this pop culture zeitgeist, we feel somewhat obligated to see it just to keep up with the conversation. You literally don't have to. And if you're not a part of the conversation, guess what? Life will go on and the conversation will stop.
Yep.
Like, even like a hit movie, like, it just sort of fades away. Venom was a huge hit. This week, no one's really talking about it much. Yeah. We're just done.
Remember when everyone
missed it, who cares?
Everyone was rushing out to see Doctor Strange. Nobody talks about Doctor Strange.
It's a fun movie. I liked it, but we don't need to.
Efficient, but
We don't need to make it part of our lives. It's okay. So, yeah, anyway, let's move on.
You can skip Star Wars Episode 9.
All right, let's move on to another.
Here's a message from Belle. Belle writes in a lot. Hello, okay. Belle. Dear Biz and Whitney, a couple of broad questions under one idea. What are the films that got you into cinema, and where do those films that initially got you into cinema stand with you presently? Also, I'm sure you've answered this, but what are your 5 to 10 favorite films? Do you have such a list?
We did the last episode of our previous podcast was all about our 5-10 favorite films, but let's tackle those one at a time. What were the movies that got you into film? If you picked the two or three movies that you could pinpoint.
When I was a kid, the film I watched the most frequently was The Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
It was one of the few we had on home video, so it was just in my house, and I watched that 100 times. And it didn't necessarily get me into cinema, but it sort of introduced me to this notion of what cinema can do to my brain.
Yeah.
You know, especially if you watch it 1,000 times.
I mean, it's hard to, like, your first film probably isn't the film that got you into cinema because we're just so inundated with media now.
Yeah.
It's the film that kind of opened your eyes is what really matters.
I started working in a movie theater when I was 16 years old, and I wasn't really, like, I watched a lot of movies. I went to the video store all the time, but I wasn't, like, a movie obsessive. I wasn't, like, absorbing a lot of details. And it was living in that culture that sort of got me into this idea that there's more than I thought there was. Also, going to the video store and just browsing around, absorbing titles just by osmosis kind of introduced me to what all this was. And, embarrassingly, it was John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness that really kind of, it was the first like horror movie in a long time that had really just sort of gotten under my skin. And I realized, wait a minute, horror films can really kind of provoke my teenage imagination a little bit. And then I saw Eraserhead, and it was all over.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's interesting because, okay, so my story was I had to switch schools when I was in the third grade, but it was really late in the year. There was only like 2 months left in it, and my mom was a teacher, so she was like, we didn't really believe in homeschooling, but at this point, we might as well not bother with this whole weird transition where I'm not going to make any friends anyway. Let's just spend like the last 6 weeks of the school year, and I'll give you math worksheets and we'll do some projects and keep me up to date. And she was really, really great at it. And what parts of that education was...
I think that's kind of a wise decision.
Given the specific set of circumstances. And one of the things she wanted to do was teach film as part of the curriculum. Not just required reading, which I also did, but also we'll have required films. So in that chunk, in that period of time, she introduced me to a lot of films. But the ones I remember most specifically... as mind-blowing were Strangers on a Train, which we recently covered and critically acclaimed. Mrs. Miniver, which is just one of my favorite movies still. They actually all are. Citizen Kane. Those were all movies that really just completely, they were more mature movies than what I'd been absorbing as a kid, but they were also, because they were in the production code, they weren't full of things that were completely like alien to me or, you know, too mature or too violent or too scary for me. So, I felt like a more mature cinema goer at the time, and that introduced me to classic cinema. But the film that introduced me to like modern art house cinema, you know, really exciting cinema, was Lost Highway. So another David Lynch.
Yeah, there you go. David Lynch will do it to you.
And then the film that made me a big horror fan ultimately was Evil Dead 2. Because I was really scared of horror movies when I was a little kid. I had nightmares, you know, really terrified of them. Evil Dead 2 was a film where I could see so many of the seams, like the wires I could tell it was homemade.
Less threatening.
I could tell it was homemade. And that made me connect not just to the film, which is wild and fun, but also to the filmmakers who weren't very distanced from me. So that's that was important.
You could see them standing just next to the camera.
And to answer the second part of the question, I still love all those movies. Real fast, if you were to pick right now, what would be your five favorite movies off the top of your head?
Oh, golly, I don't know. That's the thing. When I was in my 20s, I had a physical list. I was writing these down. I was rearranging them. I wanted to make sure that I had, like when I was 20 years old, I had all of this like very carefully annotated. So I could like whip this thing out of my pocket when somebody asked me the question. And the older I get, and the more and more and more films I see, and the wide variety of types of films I see, and the various feelings they give me, has really muddied up that list. There isn't like one that's sticking out above all the others anymore.
I do have a favorite film. Okay. It's a film I came to very gradually.
But Eraserhead's my favorite film.
There you go. It's a film I very gradually came to over time. It's a movie that I consider flawless. It hits me every single time. It hits me like a ton of bricks every single time. I think it's just perfect. It's called Searching for Bobby Fischer.
Okay.
It's directed by Steve Zaillian, who wrote Schindler's List. And it is a story of a young chess prodigy named Josh Waitzkin and his father, who becomes overbearing in that way a sports dad would. And the strain that his genius puts on their relationship. It's fantastic. It's brilliant. It's exciting. The final chess game, I say, is more exciting than any sports game I've ever seen in a movie. Like, it's a real thrill. Yeah. It's really incredibly done. It's accessible to everyone. It's fantastic. My second favorite movie, if I were to say, and I think I can say it pretty confidently,
is it Sneakers?
It's Sneakers. Fantastic heist movie. Brilliant screenplay. Both films star Ben Kingsley.
By coincidence,
total
sure,
coincidence. Yeah. I mean, he's a great actor, but it's not like I'm the biggest Ben Kingsley fan ever. RoboCop, one of my very favorite movies. What else is on? I'm trying to remember. Rockula is maybe my favorite dumb movie. Brain Donors is probably my favorite dumb broad comedy.
Brain Donors. We've said this before. Like when you first invited me into your apartment, one of the early first times we met, you were showing off your video collection in that Spring Breakers sort of way. Look at how much. And you had a DVD of Brain Donors, like, hey, you have this. And we, like, looked at each other. It's like, yeah, this is a kindred soul. We're going to make thousands of podcasts.
The Monster Squad was very influential to me growing up, as was The Last Starfighter. Going back to older stuff, Citizen Kane is actually still one of my favorites. The Palm Beach Story. I love within with every fiber of my being.
I went through this period in my early 20s when I was just trying to absorb a lot of like international cinema and classic cinema. That's when I started like going to other people's lists. And
yeah,
so I started falling in love with stuff like Ingmar Bergman's Persona and really kind of uncovering the work of Ozu and trying to get like really deep into that art house scene. And so a lot of those sort of rank high on my list.
Well, I'll ask one more follow-up question. What is the movie that came out most recently that you feel comfortable saying is one of your favorite films?
Most recently?
The most recent film you could say, yeah, that's going to be one of my favorite films forever, probably.
Well, this year, Sorry to Bother You is definitely up on that
list.
Oh,
okay.
Because it's like an Alex Cox film. It's just wild and strange.
I haven't seen it. I was going to say Get Out. I think it's a perfect horror movie. I think it nails every single thing it does.
For sure, from 2003, Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World.
Same.
Is one of my favorites.
I love it too.
I know it's just aggressively male. There's not a single feminine concern in that movie, but I still love it.
There's hardly a female character in the movie. They show up. But
there's a shot of a woman. I'm not going to call her a character. Belle goes on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was
I thought that was just a
question. No, she wants to give her own experience. For me, I had never gone to a theater save to see Ratatouille when I was 7 until I saw The Avengers. I'm guessing that's 2012's The Avengers.
Probably not the Ray Fiennes Uma Thurman one.
Everyone was talking about it at school. Oh, so it was definitely the 98 Avengers. And I asked my dad, who had already seen it twice, if I could go. I thought it was really fun, and it became a tradition for us to go see every MCU movie on opening day afterwards, going so far as driving across the entire island of Kauai to find the one theater for the release of Captain America: The Winter Soldier. But really, it was my dad on a whim taking me to see Interstellar that blew my mind so hard that I instantly fell in love with cinema. Nowadays, I've rewatched The Avengers maybe twice, and it's still quite fun, though quite cheesy. I've grown to love the characters through the franchise, even though it's formulaic. Interstellar is still a visual masterpiece and has one of the best film scores ever written, although, fun fact, Hans Zimmer never wrote it down because he can't read sheet music. I had heard that. Though I find it a bit slow, a bit bloated, and the ending really tagged on. I genuinely think if it had just ended with McConaughey floating in space with the spaceships as dots in the distance, I would have just lost it on first viewing. My favorite films are currently, number one, The Dark Knight.
Great movie.
Number two, There Will Be Blood.
Also a great movie. I like it more than you.
Strangely shaped movie. Number three, Steve Jobs.
Okay.
She says the dialogue is music.
It is a really, really good movie, and I think everyone assumed it was going to win too many Oscars, and then it won nothing.
It kind of backed off.
And then it's kind of disappeared. But yeah, it should not be forgotten. It's a really well-crafted film.
It's got a really great screenplay.
Yeah.
Number four, La La Land.
Not my favorite.
Not my favorite either.
I like it fine. I think my critiques of La La Land got blown up a little bit because they were flying in the face of, say, Scott Mance, who thinks it's the best movie ever made. I think it's pretty far from that. But it's fine.
I deeply respect and I deeply admire Scott Mance.
Yes.
He's wrong about La La Land. And I will say that right to his face, and I will get into a debate with him. Number five, Unbreakable. She says it made me appreciate simplicity. I like Unbreakable. I was actually a booster for Unbreakable long before it was hip.
Yeah, Unbreakable takes all of the basic ideas of the superhero genre and strips away all of the bigness.
Yeah, there's no glitz. Yeah, there's no glitz at all.
And I think if Unbreakable had come out 10 years later, it would have been really well respected. Mm. But mainstream movie audiences weren't inundated with comic book lore and storytelling, and I don't think they understood exactly what Shyamalan was getting at.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping Glass is really good. I'm looking forward to that.
Let's hope so. Number six, Call Me By Your Name. So atmospheric and emotional, and Timothée Chalamet, yes, please. No, Bibiani, the luxury is not a turnoff. You know, if you want to close your eyes and picture yourself as an art professor who lives in a villa in Italy, who gets to walk outside of your house and go swimming on a whim and eat apricots off of trees, and your servants bring you fresh fish every night, and all you do is discuss art. Yeah, that's a great film. if that's your luxury fantasy, and it's everyone's. Yeah. Number seven, Inception. So many layers. Get it.
I love that movie.
Number eight, Amadeus. Best musical ever, period.
I'm hesitant to call it a musical, but it's a great music movie. Yeah. And it's certainly one of my favorite movies, actually. I love that one.
It's No A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which is another one of my favorite movies.
Fair enough.
Number nine, 12 Angry Men. Mm. Most intelligent film I've seen, though frankly I would like to see a woman or two, maybe a non-binary, represent at the table. Who knows, throw a different race in there to actually make things crazy. It was made in 1957.
Yeah.
It was 12 white dudes.
Yeah.
that is just probably
it warrants. I think that one actually warrants a remake. You can even mostly keep script.
They did remake it,
a recent one.
Mike Nichol. Well, I guess this is like in the '90s.
Yeah. I think another one. Okay. I think that one warrants a restaging with a different kind of cast. I think that would be a good idea.
It's been done on stage as 12 Angry Jurors, and I've seen 12 Angry Women. Yeah. And number 10, The Grand Budapest Hotel, hilarious and cute. Thank you again for your time. Reading this letter took quite a bit, and I do apologize. The best of luck to William in the Schmodown Championship, and to Whitney, also in the Schmodown, with Matt Nost. Also, Beowulf is my single most favorite wrong answer to every given in a tournament. Beowulf, what was the question? Oh, I was in the big Schmodown Championship.
Oh, yeah. It was the name of...
So what is the name of Ron Weasley's mother in the Harry Potter films? It's like, I don't know. Ron Weasley's mother, so I wrote down Beowulf.
It's this weird thing when you're in the Schmodown, and people get on you if you don't guess. I know my answer will be wrong, but often I'll just, if I'm like, I don't know.
Write down something funny.
Something funny, or even just something that like makes it seem like I at least had a general idea. Like, there's one question I had, which was, name a movie in which Bruce Willis played, I think he played an alcoholic Vietnam veteran, and I didn't know the movie. And I was trying to think of what movie could it possibly be that I could make a guess. And they didn't say he starred in it. So I'm like, listen, I haven't seen Born on the 4th of July since it came out in 1989. Maybe he has a scene? Like, maybe he has, like, a cameo or something? And, like, that was, like, a memorable moment that I have forgotten. So I said... Born on the 4th of July. And so many people were mad. It's like, he wasn't in Born on the... Tom Cruise was in that movie. I'm like, I know Tom Cruise is in it. I wanted to say something, and I thought maybe he was a supporting part that I forgot. That was my idea. It was wrong, but yeah. And so will you do that a lot? It happens all the time. But yeah, yours was one of the sillier ones. It was really funny.
Beowulf Weasley. Sure, why not?
Yeah.
Here's a letter from Hayden. Hello, okay. Hayden. We have several Haydens, right?
We do, actually. It's interesting.
Hello. In your conversation about Black Klansman, which was fantastic, Whitney said he was done with The Birth of a Nation. I thought it would be interesting to tell you how my film teacher thought about The Birth of a Nation. Well, he felt that it was important to teach us about the film and had us watch a few clips. He heavily emphasized how racist the film was. To quote him, I'm sad that I have to teach this film. I wish I didn't have to. He never even called it problematic. He flat out called it racist. I feel that this is the right way to teach the film. I would never want the film to be erased from history, but that would be irresponsible. But I would focus more on the racist aspects than praising the film or very much try not to justify it too much.
There's a lot of really ugly chapters and even individuals in cinema history that are uncomfortable to talk about and we're not proud of as an industry or an art form. But you have to at least bring them up in certain contexts. Like, if you want to talk about the evolution of feature filmmaking, you have to at least mention that The Birth of a Nation was the first. You have to mention it. You have to say, well, technically the first one was The Birth of a Nation. I'm not going to require you to watch that because it is so unbelievably racist that it will probably make you, like, pull the DVD out of your player, snap it in half, and burn it. Like, I wouldn't judge you for that. I mean, I'm not saying we should destroy the film. I would never say that, but... I'm not encouraging anyone to go out and see it unless they really, really, really feel motivated to.
Well, it's become one of those things where we can only appreciate it from an objective technical standpoint. There's nothing about the story that I feel like apologizing for ever.
There's no need to apologize for it. It's just we can condemn it, but it has historical significance, so we do have to mention it once in a while.
And there was a time in film school where I would say, well, you know, Birth of a Nation, yeah, it's racist, but, and I'm not going to say it's racist, but anymore. It's racist, period.
Yeah.
It's full of, and it's based on this horrible piece of propaganda. These you know, books and writings at the time that were based on these sort of racist panic pamphlets that were being circulated around the South. It's just racist lies.
That conversation gets a little bit more complicated when you look at films that are not like necessarily racist in their construct but have racist elements.
Yeah.
But that's a different conversation. With something like Birth of a Nation, Yeah, fuck that movie.
Yeah.
Fuck that movie.
So, yeah, I think your film teacher, Hayden, had the right idea, I think, to show clips of, like, sort of the technicals that it was the first to kind of nail and introduce into cinema language.
Or if you must, like, skip it. Like, when my film school, we skipped Birth of a Nation. We didn't show Birth of a Nation. We talked about it.
Yeah.
We made sure everyone understood it. But then it's like, if you want to see a D.W. Griffith movie, we're going to watch Intolerance.
Which
is a more interesting film in a lot of ways.
And it was actually...
Even technically, it's a more interesting film.
Even at the time... Birth of a Nation was people were crying foul. It's like, this is a racist movie, D.W. Griffith. It's like, no, it's about sort of the rise of the South. No, watch your movie again. And he did. He's like, oh, crap, I just did something terrible.
Uh-huh.
And he made Intolerance as sort of penance.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you this right now. Does not make up for it.
Doesn't
Birth of a Nation has a really lasting, ugly legacy. Yeah. But Intolerance is, in itself, a really good and really complicated movie that the likes of which were not being made right now, or at the time. It's a movie that takes place over multiple periods in history in various stories of intolerance throughout the ages. Yeah, it doesn't erase what Birth of a Nation wrought. But it is good, and that one is actually worth watching. There's actually several D.W. Griffith movies I think are worth watching, but man, Birth of a Nation. No, thank you. Here's a letter from... Right. Oh, was there more?
No, that was it.
Okay. Here's a letter from Dan.
Hi, Dan.
And it's a short one, and I actually do want to talk about it a little bit.
Okay.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm listening right now to your critically acclaimed of February 18th, 2018. This is a very recent letter.
Okay.
It's not to go that far back. And in passing, you mentioned not really bickering much. I just wanted to tell you that a major part of why I enjoy and appreciate your podcast is that you don't do the performative verbal roughhousing, which it seems like a lot of men feel they should / must. I like that you guys seem comfortable being sweet with each other. Smiley face. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah.
And I actually, I'm actually... That's a nice compliment, and thank you for that. But I think that raises something. One thing we want to do is have polite discourse. Like, I'll occasionally, I know you well enough, I can occasionally say, shut up.
Yeah.
Or even in jest, fuck you. But it's never anger. I do, as a person, love you, man.
Oh, that's so sweet of you to say.
And it's true. And I respect what you say about cinema, which is why I keep wanting to do podcasts with you.
Even when I say... Hellfest is okay, and you're just not okay with that.
Oh, you're abundantly wrong about that one, but whatever, it's fine. Like, I don't give a shit.
I'm also not gonna like leap in front of Hellfest. I'll let it be grist for the mill. I just thought it was fine.
Bickering can be entertaining, and it can sometimes illuminate our differences. But if you're not gonna be respectful about it, what's the fucking point? All you're doing is arguing, and no one's ever gonna cede any ground. We want to have polite, you know, and forths about movies, and that's way more interesting, I think, in the long run. Maybe that's me.
There's a lot of there's a rather unfortunate trend in online film discourse where a lot of the so-called critics aren't necessarily critics. They're more like comedians, and they want to go to films so they can have a bit. They, like, sort of mock it or sort of edit it into a funny video and... kind of take the stance of someone who hates cinema, whether or not they actually do.
Well, I mean, and that can lead to good comedy. You were one of your favorite comedy bits ever is Richard Jenny's bit about Jaws the Revenge.
Yeah, where he's just sort of slagging on Jaws the Revenge, which, to be fair, is a bad movie.
Yeah, and it's a very funny routine. Find that on YouTube. Richard Jenny, and he does this Jaws
funny,
the Revenge.
He does this funny routine about, you know, hating on this movie before that was really sort of a vogue thing to do.
But when you talk about a popular movie or a hit movie or a movie everyone's familiar with, it's a shared experience, and then you can get into this weird minutia, and people can joke about it and laugh about it and talk about why it's funny. Like there's a lot of really good comedic bits about Star Wars. Patton Oswalt has at least one or two that are really, really brilliant. If you don't know Star Wars, it's not funny. But you do know Star Wars, so it is. But yeah, you're right. Like, when we treat comedy routines as criticism, we're kind of just being jerks.
Or criticism as comedy routine. I'm a big fan of a podcast called How Did This Get Made?
A lot of people are.
It's a big hit. I listen to that when I can. It's three comedians, not critics, actors and comedians who are involved in the making of films, who, yeah, they're not looking for analysis. They're not talking about a movie. They're just sort of pointing out goofy crap about movies they know are already bad, or at least have a reputation for being bad.
Yeah, every once in a while, I'll have someone defend it, but usually...
They watched Face Off, which is a ridiculous movie, but it's enjoyable.
It knows it's ridiculous. Yeah. It's called Face Off.
Face slash off.
Yeah, they knew what they were doing. That movie is very aware of its own weirdness.
It ends with a boat chase, for God's sake. It knows what it's doing.
Yeah, no good film has a boat chase.
Okay. Explain to me, you're in a boat. Somebody is in a boat and he's driving off. You get in a boat and you chase him. What do you do? How does that end?
Well, you hit him with the boat and then you jump on the boat and then you fight him and then you try to cut your own face off so he can't get your face.
Oh, perfectly. So the goal here is to jump onto his boat.
Look, John Woo is from this classical school of thriller filmmaking, and Hitchcock was the same way, where sometimes you put a scene in a movie because you think it would be neat.
Just because it would look neat.
Like, North by Northwest is a collection of bits that Hitchcock couldn't find room for in other movies. Oh, I want to do a chase across Mount Rushmore. Doesn't really fit in anything else. We'll build a movie around it. Mm. Like, that's kind of how that movie was structured, and they worked in that one. Face Off, there's a huge shootout in a church. Fortunately, there are boats next to it. Let's just enjoy, shall we? Let's have some fun.
I've really, like, as exciting as car chases can be in movies or motorcycle chases, there's always been that part of me that says, well, okay, so you're in a car, you're pursuing, say you're in the rear of the car chase, and they're driving away and you're chasing them. What's your goal? Like, once you catch up to them, you're still both in speeding cars.
Yeah.
Are you trying to gram into their car? Are you trying to kill them?
You're just trying to make sure they don't get away.
Okay.
And if they get away, you failed.
But they always get away.
They don't always get away. Oh, okay. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they crash their car. Or they run out of gas. Or they get bored and they just run out.
My point is all car chases are completely stupid.
Mostly, yes. Most car chases are only there because it's a movie. The one car chase that that comes to mind that isn't stupid, it makes perfect sense, is actually not... When I think of a car chase, I think of two cars. Mm. If it's a car and something else... Technically, but I don't really think of it as a car chase. But French Connection makes sense.
Okay.
The bad guy is, and the bad guy is a really bad guy, and he is in an elevated train, and we need to beat him to the next stop, so Gene Hackman gets in a car, and he's trying to beat the train, which has no obstructions, so he's got to drive like a maniac and dodge a lot of traffic.
Well, and
that's a great scene.
And it's really realistic, because it's just on the streets.
Yeah. That one is relatively grounded and fine. I actually really like the another William Friedkin movie, The Car Chase Into Live and Die in L.A., because they're actually trying to, like, kill the guy who's in the car, and it makes sense. Mm-hmm. But your cat is in the sink.
Yeah. Or like, I remember in Terminator 2, like, the liquid metal monster, like,
trying to kill the person in the car. That's his end game. If he gets in the car, the person's dead.
He's in a semi, and he's chasing them down, like, the L.A. River, but it's established that he can already run as fast as a car. Like, driving a semi into the river, it's a cool visual.
Yeah.
But why are you doing that?
Anyway. It's cool. I need to get the cat.
I hate cool. Your awesome sucks. I've said it before. Here is a letter from Alex. And this is a letter. It's called A Question of Representation. Okay. Greetings, gentlemen. I want to tell you first that you are my favorite critics.
Oh my God, thank you.
My goodness.
There's a lot of us out there. You don't have to pick us, but thank you.
Thank you so much. I discovered you by Linoleum Knife when Bibbs appeared on What the Flick. I was not disappointed to follow your work for the past 3 years. I love your views on cinema. You seem like quite nice people. And if I were not a French-speaking guy from Quebec, by the way, sorry if there are some mistakes, I would love hanging out with guys like you.
You can still hang out with us.
Yeah.
I know a little French.
We love the Québécois.
Yeah.
I know a little bit about Quebec. I read it in a book once.
Yeah. I understand French better than I speak it, but I understand French pretty well.
Anyway, I wanted your point of view about representation in movies. Art is always reflective of some parts of the world, but I have the feeling that until recently, Hollywood didn't care about it. They were mostly thinking about the white and male audience.
Yeah.
But this we were just talking about. Of course, there were pictures with females or people from different ethnicities in the lead, but they were so rare. Spike Lee, in his most recent Black Klansman, an excellent movie, remembered that there were some black movies with female antagonists, but I never heard of them before, probably because we're so focused on the box office that those little successes or bombs are almost anonymous. Now that Hollywood is seeing Wonder Woman, Black Panther, and even Crazy Rich Asians getting a lot of money, do you think it will change? And do you consider that there are any groups who need better representation? I can think of a couple. Even if there is progress, the LGBTQ+ community deserves better than now. As a gay man myself, it would be fun to see more gay characters in more genres than drama or romantic comedy. Also, you will laugh, but how about fat characters?
Yeah, I'm not gonna. Yeah. I was gonna bring that up. Yes,
just incidentally fat characters. There's, yeah. I can think of one example where, and it's not even where there's a fat character, pretty obese character who is their weight is not mentioned.
Uh-huh.
They're just incidentally fat, and strangely enough, it's Analyze This. The one with Billy Crystal and Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
He has a teenage son who is morbidly obese and nobody says a damn thing.
Oh, okay, I don't even
just,
remember
he
that.
He just
character.
Has an obese son and it's not.
I haven't seen that movie since like 99. As,
yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway. I mean, overweight men are most of the time the butt of the joke,
yep.
Stupid, victims as in horror, villains generally henchmen, or unhappy about their weight. Same for the women, where fat ladies are mostly a pretext to make some jokes about them. I'm looking at you, shallow Hal.
Yeah.
How about characters who are leads and yes, happen to be bigger? The goal is not to promote obesity, but in life there are chubby people, and there are people, and those people can do a lot of things. I would love to see more of them in different roles, including leads, and no, not just because heavy men are eye candy for me.
Fair enough.
Yeah, there's a great variety of people. Joel Schumacher kind of represents, he said something that kind of represents a lot of the Hollywood view of this. He was very candid about this. When people asked him about his Batman movies, Batman Forever and Batman and Robin, they sort of came at him and were really critical of the way he luxuriated in the lead's bodies. He liked to sort of zoom in on pecs and bodies and, you know, when... Mm-hmm. He in the commentary track for Batman Forever, he talked about just how gorgeous Nicole Kidman was, and he put her in that Veronica Lake hair and sweeping sheets. And he was actually very frank about saying, well, when we go to see movies, when I go to see movies anyway, I want to see really beautiful people.
Yeah.
I want, you know, like the highest possible beauty standards. And he's not thinking about representation at all. He just wants... He's a visual filmmaker.
He's interested
so he wants
in what he
of,
thinks is pretty.
Yeah.
He specifically said, I think it might have been one of those commentary tracks, but I can't remember, that when he makes a movie, he picks one or two people in the cast and he makes it his goal to make them as beautiful and alluring and captivating as possible, partially for entertainment value.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a lot of that sort of, we're only casting thin, beautiful people is less to do with representation and more to do just with aesthetics.
But that's part of the problem is that when we normalize an aesthetic, we start coming up with bullshit justifications for not to have representation.
I was just about to say that.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
So let you get your point.
Anyways, he continues. Finally, mental illness. You talked a little bit about it when you analyzed Dead Man on Campus, but such a taboo subject deserves better treatment.
Yes.
I'm tired of seeing mental problems portrayed by terrorists or villains or others with bulging eyes screaming their insanities. Mental illnesses don't always provoke hallucinations or totally losing contact with reality. People with depression or anxiety look totally normal on the outside. But inside, this is a battlefield where you don't fight aliens, but your inner monologue telling you you're worth nothing.
Yeah.
Telling you that you'll get robbed, attacked, those around you will hate you if you speak your mind, or that two American critics will find your long email stupid and humiliate you on their podcast.
You are wonderful and stop that.
That would never happen.
You don't need, right? Listen.
At least not around these parts.
You don't have to worry about that at all. You're fine.
That's what people having social anxiety like me or other mental issues live every day. I can think it can be potential for a good character building and stories that will touch way more people than the stereotypical main lead of an action movie. I feel like in action movies, they try, but they're written so badly, they fail all the time.
A lot of action movies are so shallow that representation doesn't even come across.
So when it comes to mental illness, like they'll try to establish that somebody has a tragic backstory, and we meet our hero, and he's leaning over a bar drinking whiskey, and that's the only thing we get.
One of the films that frustrated me in its depiction of mental illness recently was The Predator, which the significant part of the supporting cast...
It doesn't know anything about mental illness.
Yeah, were people who were institutionalized for mostly post-traumatic stress problems, but various mental health issues. And the movie treats them like wacky sidekicks who can solve all their problems by just quote-unquote manning up, getting a gun, and resorting back to soldiering. And that's a really unhealthy view to normalize, and that's not great.
It would play like satire if there were any wit to that movie, but there isn't.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, and again, going back to that hero leaning over the bar thing, you know, it's like they're struggling with depression. Maybe they have anxiety every day, but the implication is that the events of the movie are so urgent that they're able to sort of overcome really easily. And it's always treated as if mental illness is this thing that you can just get over.
Yeah, you can solve by going through like a big dramatic event. Like it's not. It never is.
Like American Sniper was like that too. It's like you have PTSD, but you can just get over that. It's like really this unhealthy
view. I actually think we blame movies a lot for this. I think we blame TV. We should blame TV more for this. The episodic nature of a lot of television in which like, oh yeah, someone was involved in like a police officer is involved in a shooting. And like maybe they'll have an episode where they deal with the ramifications of that. Yeah. Two episodes later, they're fine.
Because they have another story and we just don't see that part of their personality.
That can linger your entire life. That's actually like when you suffer through something really dramatic, it can really have an impact on everything you do. And some shows just are so eager to get back to the baseline that they will give the short shrift to severe, life problems and psychological issues.
I feel like some shows do okay. Like you look at Law and Order SVU, the characters do, they're witness to all kinds of trauma, and eventually, over the course of many seasons, you see them just get more and more depressed, and eventually they're like, I can't handle this anymore. I've been having this horrible time with my own depression, and eventually, like, one of the characters might leave.
I think that there are a lot of shows that do a good job. I'm certainly not blaming all television for this. One show I think does a really, really good job of this is Avatar: The Last Airbender. Believe it or not, it is a wonder. You haven't seen it. It's one of the best shows ever. I just flat out stand by that. And
I've seen some. It's okay.
But one of the things that works so great is that it's serialized, and the events that befall the various characters have an emotional impact. And one of the things you always complain about with Harry Potter is that it boils down to Harry trying to kill Voldemort at the end. That's like, the whole point.
We're training a teenage boy to murder a guy.
Yeah. And in Avatar The Last Airbender, everyone assumes that's what Aang is supposed to do to Fire Lord Ozai. Mm. And by the end of the series, it's like, but I won't.
I'm not going to kill the guy.
I would never do that. But what do I do? How do I stop him if it is him or me? How do I not betray my principles but also save the world decisively? And that's something that he really wrestles with, and it's really painful for him. It's great. It really, really works. Your letter covered a vast swath of topics.
There's a little more.
Oh, God. Okay. Jesus. Okay.
It's just to wrap it up.
I'm not complaining. I just thought it was over.
Basically, it's terrible, but I would like to see more characters with my reality on the screen. Maybe it's egoistic on my part. I don't know. You'll be the judge of that. Sorry for the long message. As you probably understood, it took me a lot of effort to write to you, even though I wanted to for a long time, so I had a lot to say. Perhaps I'll dare correspond with you another time, and I will be shorter, I promise. Thanks immensely for reading my message, and never forget that you're both the best, Alex.
Okay, Alex.
Sweet of you to say.
Thank you for writing. As someone who also deals with my own level of social anxiety and depression in particular, those are my two bigger issues, I understand how difficult it can be to reach out. There are people who I know personally in the industry or are friends who I still am uncomfortable to. Hell, here's an example I'll be just flat out honest about. I was at a screening of Halloween this week, and Christian Harloff, who I know really well and we text like a couple of times a week just about Schmodown stuff, was like a little bit behind me in line, and I couldn't bring myself to talk to him because I thought I would be a bother.
Aww.
That's ridiculous. I know in my head I know it's ridiculous, but for me that was my reality. So I can appreciate that, and thank you for writing in, and it was a really, really good letter, and it really brought up a lot of stuff. So much stuff that I'm worried we're not going to cover it all, but the short answer I just want to get to is it's not egoist to want to see your reality, your situation, your lifestyle, or however you identify.
Or just your interests.
It's not egoist to see it on screen. It's egoist to only want to see that on screen. But there's a lot of people who are underrepresented on screen. There's a lot of white heterosexual dudes who are the stars of stories and telling stories. When critics like us complain about that, we're not saying it's bad to be a white heterosexual dude. We're saying is that the ratio is way off.
And white heterosexual dudes have been the center of the stories for so long. The assumption culturally has long been that that's the only perspective worth seeing.
That's the baseline. That's quote unquote normal.
There were some cartoon executives in the 1980s who said things like this, shows with girl protagonists, shows with girls are for girls, shows with boys are for everyone. And yeah. and that's still sort of the mindset we're in.
I was working in development after college for a little bit, and you know, the typical post development is the part of the entertainment industry where you find an idea or a script and you work it,
develop it,
you make it so that it's something that can make a good movie, and that involves everything from deciding, does the story work, is it marketable, can we get a good cast for it. There was like one script, one of my favorite scripts I've ever read, and I was like, we should totally try to make this. And they were just like, the problem with this script is literally you can only, the only actor working today who could sell it is Tina Fey. And if we can't get Tina Fey, then it's a waste of money to even buy the script. And that's a harsh reality. But one of the things that came up in that environment was, you know, casting, come up with casting lists, people who are appropriate for it, and race is an issue. Race does come up, and one of the things was the quote unquote rule that I had heard was movies with like mixed race casts don't make money, or movies that aren't about white people don't make a lot of money. And I said, what about Hitch, which had only recently come out, and it starred Will Smith and Eva Mendes, and it was a huge hit. And they were just like, that's the exception. Okay, what about Rush Hour? There were three of those, and they were huge blockbusters. That's the exception. Okay, what about Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon? That was made over $100 million. Didn't even have anyone speaking English. They're all Chinese. And they said, that is also the exception. I'm like, how many exceptions do you get? Like, well, it's just not a rule.
It's so unbelievably insulting to think that they're only thinking of a white audience. It's like, well, we can put these white characters on a screen and everyone will go see it. But so black people will, like a black audience, will go see these films with white protagonists, but white people won't go see the films with the black protagonists.
It's ridiculous.
It's like, that's insane. What are you talking about?
Yeah. It's fundamentally ridiculous, and we're starting, finally, I think, to turn a corner. I do think films like Black Panther, Crazy Rich Asians,
movies that, and I've said this before, it's kind of unfortunate that we have to, you know, gauge financial success in this, but that's kind of what we're talking about.
That was the justification for a lot of the racism in the industry, was that movies that didn't star white people don't make money, and movies, listen, the fundamental reality of cinema is that movies are expensive to make. Yeah. Even cheap movies are relatively expensive to make. You can make the greatest painting ever painted with $10 worth of canvas and paint. Theoretically, anyway. All right. And of course, many years of work and talent and whatever, but like just the materials.
Right.
Movies, even a cheap movie costs thousands of dollars. A modest movie costs millions, and an expensive movie costs hundreds of millions. You need to be able to make that money back. That's one of the problems. Wow. That's one of the reasons why so many brilliant filmmakers have trouble, is because raising the money to make the kind of movies that they want is difficult because they're not seen as marketable, which is another one of the reasons why you can't use marketability or box office success as a gauge of quality, because it has very little to do with it a lot of the time. Good ones get made, but it's not a deciding factor. Anyway, my point is that we created these bullshit rules and then we enforced them long after we had all the proof in the world that they were bullshit. So we do need more representation. We need more representation of the entire spectrum of experience. And speaking as someone who is, I myself am, and I'll use the word, I am a fat man.
Okay.
You know, watching all of these movies and TV shows where fat people are treated as jokes, punchlines, less than. Hell, I remember watching Star Wars for the first time and realizing that, and I was a fat kid, the only fat person in that movie is named Porkins and dies horribly in one scene.
And his last name is like...
His last name is Porkins.
Burger Eater or something.
No, his name was Jack Porkins.
Jack Porkins.
Jack.
Like Jack,
J-E-K.
Like Jack Perkins from Minnesota Public Television?
Sure.
Okay.
But yeah, and then there's no one of my girth in Empire Strikes Back. And then who's the fat character we get in Return of the Jedi? Jabba the Hutt. I felt really like left out of Star Wars.
We don't know how svelte he is to his people. Maybe
that's true. But when you think about the you know, the archetype that he is playing, this, like, you know...
Hedonist.
This hedon... Like, when you look at Hedonism Bot in Futurama...
Doesn't even have arms and legs. It just sort of sits there.
Yeah, but he's like Jabba the Hutt on a giant chaise lounge. Like, I didn't feel very welcome in Star Wars. All of these things are really, really pervasive. My experience is not better or worse than anyone else's. We need representation across the board because the ratio is calamitously off. Still, it's getting a little better, but it's still calamitously off.
I've never seen myself in a movie. I've always had really strange interests. I've always had sort of a kind of unique upbringing. Sure, I'm a white male. And I've seen plenty of white males, but they never represented my interests. They were always like these sort of macho heroes that I was expected to project myself into. I'm not a violent guy. Yeah. I don't want to take up a gun and start kicking ass. That doesn't fulfill my fantasies. I don't know what it's like to be represented, and I've never longed for it in a strange way.
Okay.
Now, that may be my position as a white man, where I can say that.
Yeah, that might be an element of your privilege.
My privilege is coloring that view. But I want everyone to be represented, and I'm not holding my breath to see myself represented.
That's your perspective, and everyone gets their own.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. Well, that was a heavy one.
Yeah.
here's another heavy one.
Okay.
This letter comes from Chris.
Hi, Chris.
Dear Bibbs and Whitney, I wanted to write about something that's been really bugging me lately. To say that we're living in troubling times is putting it very lightly, and to take me away from all that crap, I've been trying to watch more movies to get my mind off these things. But the problem is that every time I put my phone down or turn it off and try to watch a movie, I can't help but not check my phone and check what's happening in the news or check what the people I follow on Twitter are saying, including you two, and all I hear is about politics and how everything is going to hell and all the stuff is holding me back from watching the movie. I just can't stop thinking about all this horrible, horrible, horrible stuff, and I just keep wanting to check my phone and just check everything, and eventually I completely ignore the movie, or when I try to watch the movie and try to hide my phone or something like that and just try to watch a movie, it feels like the worst thing ever when you watch a movie. It makes it feel like a chore, and that's terrible. So I don't really know what to do or how to relax and just watch movies if I keep feeling everything in the world is going to shit. The news is everywhere, and I can't get away from it. How can I watch a movie if there's so much crap going on in the world, and how do you two deal with it in terms of watching films at home? Sorry if this feels like a rant. Everyone thinks they're ranting. You're all great. Don't worry about it. If you're under 1,000 words, you're fine. I just want to get your guys' opinion. Anyway, thanks for the podcast. YouTube bright up my life every week, and thank you for that. Yeah,
thank you.
That's a good question, and it's something I think a lot of people are dealing with now.
As for turning off your phone, you just got to turn off your phone. You have to train yourself to do that. Take out the battery, hide it in a drawer. Hide the components around the house. And if you're thinking about it, you can push through. You can push through that curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
We just saw a movie recently called The Oath about a fellow who's checking his phone all the dang time.
And I've been doing the same thing. And I
do the same thing. And you know what? Knowing that at that moment won't change your life. It's just a weird sort of obsession. We've all been going through it.
The 24-hour news cycle is invented, and it's relatively recent in human history. Mm. When I watch older movies that take place like before the 90s, I'm astounded by how quiet people's lives are. Or they read a newspaper, like, oh, this happened yesterday morning. Interesting. Yeah. Like, wow, didn't know that until now.
Think of, without a phone, how would you have gotten this information in 1991?
Yeah.
You would have gone about your business throughout the day. You wouldn't have known what was going on. It wouldn't have been on the television.
Mm-hmm. At least not for a bit. Maybe in the evening.
If it was, like, really, really serious, you might have had a breaking news report in the middle of the day. One of them. You would have gone home at night. You'd have watched the evening news, and that's when you would have gotten the information, when it had already been vetted and, put into context. So the newsmakers would have figured out
the most important elements, and there wouldn't have been a ton of editorializing. It would have just kind of just been, here's what happened.
Yeah, the editorializing would have come in New Yorker like a month after the fact. Just try to picture that way of consuming the information.
That being said... And that can be healthy, and certainly I think it's healthy in bursts when you're just trying to focus on one thing.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on in the world right now, and we do want to stay informed, and we want to stay as informed as possible, and we want to stay as up to date, because every day something terrible is happening. More so than in previous, like usual. Like, go back 3 years ago, less terrible stuff happened in one day than happens now.
Yeah, it just does feel like a cavalcade of terror that's going on.
And listen, it's something I think a lot of us are struggling with, but the thing that I'm having trouble with this, and thank God I have a person in my life who helps keep me centered. Her name is Michelle. She was on an episode recently.
She can grab you by the chin and swivel your head away from the screen for a second.
But also, she reminds me of the importance of self-care. Like, you can't be good to the world if you're not taking care of yourself. And part of that means it's okay to shut things out for a bit and make sure that you're stable. Be present with the people that you love. Don't constantly put away the phone. Just focus on what's here right now in this room. This is the reality that you're living with. This is enough. Well, deal with it. Enjoy it. Take a bath. Don't watch if movies are freaking you out, because movies are full of themes that mess you up. Listen to classical music, or listen, or read a book. There's a million things you can do. Paint something.
So your solution is just to turn off the movie.
No, not necessarily. But that's one thing you can do. That's one thing you can do. If you want to shut out all of these intrusive, negative reminders and updates about reality, if that's something that is filling you with anxiety, as it fills me with anxiety, try to give yourself space. It is okay to focus on you once in a while. It is totally okay, just to make sure you're okay. Because if you're not okay, you're not going to be in a mental place to actually do anything about all the horrible stuff that goes on in the world.
Just if you're fretting, you're not accomplishing anything. Yeah. As for trying to like shut out the world and enjoy a movie, that's based on this notion that films function as escape. And certainly that is a function of film. And in fact, I think that's a very popular function of film.
I think it's how a lot of people consider
A lot of people consider movies as sort of separate from reality.
And I think all of us, even those of us who enjoy the other aspects of film, we do it too.
Yeah. It's rare, but, you know, the film is going to be reflecting reality. And I think if a film is strong enough, and if you are allowing yourself to engage deeply, you can understand how tightly it perhaps ties into the things you're viewing in the world. It can put those noises that you're constantly hearing into a broader context. It can actually calm you to see something that on screen that is as politically turbulent as the outside world.
I was having this.
It might make you feel a little bit of anxiety, but you can see that this is a different group of people who are offering different kinds of solutions and struggling in a very similar way. And all of a sudden, you're kind of shaking hands with this historical view that the film is presenting.
You can feel less alone.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't feel like no one else has ever gone through what you're going through.
When you're watching a film, if you try to put that film into its broader context and realize that it too came out of a very politically turbulent time, because it's never not politically turbulent.
It's true.
You can kind of put your own experiences into context, and that's a great way to have that noise in your head and still enjoy a feature film.
People process art very differently. One example I go to a lot is a lot of people, when they're sad, for whatever reason, they listen to music. It's very common. We all do it. But one thing I found is that, generally speaking, there are two types of people. There are people who, when they are sad, they listen to happy music, peppy music, try to cheer themselves up. I, myself, fall into that category. But then there are people who, when they are sad, and I know a lot of people who fall into this category, they listen to sad music. It makes them feel like they're not alone in their sadness. It helps them process their sadness, and they experience those emotions.
Some people are even sadder than you, like Morrissey.
But also just like experiencing those emotions, letting them, acknowledging that they exist, feeling them, and then letting them wash out is very cleansing. And that's valid too. And it's important maybe to explore both of those things, maybe try them both and see maybe there are different ways to process the art that you're processing. Anyway, it's complicated. I wish I had the easy answer, but it's something we're all struggling with. We all want to enjoy our day. We all want to enjoy our lives. Times are really bad right now, and it's difficult to do that all the time without feeling irresponsible. And I appreciate that you don't want to do that. But take time for yourself. Find if it's not movies, maybe it's not movies right now. Maybe movies are filling you with anxiety. Find something.
Yeah.
Just find something calming and peaceful and take care of yourself. We care about the world, but we also care about you as an individual. Not just you, Chris, every one of our listeners and everyone you know. We want everyone to be, you know, mentally sound and safe and okay and being able to pursue your lives and enjoy yourselves. It's an important part of life.
I think that's it. I think we have to wrap it up for now.
We do have to wrap it up for now. That's an hour of letters. Thank you, everybody who wrote in. We know a lot of other people wrote in, and this was a really heavy one.
We didn't just get people like,
hey, could you recommend some ghost movies or something? we'll do a few more of those, I think, next
time. We get a few of them. Well, I appreciate that we have a high quality of listener who are interested in sort of headier subjects
and the depth of cinema.
Happy to discuss those. I like the frivolous conversations as well. Like, what's your five favorite head explosions? Well, I'm happy to talk about that as well.
Scanners.
Scanners is right there at the top.
It's got to be. Yeah. I mean, what else? It has to.
I'm not sure if Big Trouble in Little China counts because that was a whole body that exploded.
Total Recall.
Total Recall had a head explosion.
The head, like, it goes. But when they're on Mars, like, and they're
but their eyeballs sort of pop out.
Okay, it's not enough. We should have prepped this.
My point is, I do enjoy the frivolous stuff, but I'm happy that you're eager to talk about more than just that.
Absolutely.
Dear listeners.
So everybody, thank you so much for writing in. Again, if you want to email us, letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Mm-hmm. We'll try to read some more on every episode, but we will do a proper letters episode at least one a month from here on out, just to make sure we do get some more of your letters in more of a timely fashion. We'll be back later this week with a review of all of the Hannibal Lecter movies and also the brand new Halloween sequel, which you haven't seen yet.
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
I couldn't make it to the screening, so I'm going to see it with the hoi polloi.
If you're eager, my review is currently up at The Wrap. You can check it out there if you want a preview of what I thought, but no idea what Whitney's going to think because he has weird takes on this stuff, and I'm very eager to have this debate.
I'm a huge fan of this filmmaker.
David
Gordon Green, who we got to interview once, and I couldn't contain myself.
He was cool.
Yeah, but I wasn't. I feel like I made a total ass of myself in front of David Gordon Green.
You were fine. Anyways, I promise.
Like, I think my first question was like, how do you reconcile reality with this reality? Some really stupid, brainy ass. You know, freshman in college type of question.
You were fine. It was a nice interview. But so we're going to have a lot of fun with that later in the week. So thank you, everybody, for listening. And we're on Twitter if you want to follow us or anything like that. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
And never forget, everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?